Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we record the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, October 3, 2019, is Leanne Lebecki. Thank you for joining us, Leanne.
Thank you for having me, Sue.
As we begin, could you just provide our listeners with a brief overview of your DOC career?
Sure. Initially, I was in the management intern program, and I did several internships with Ted Shoemaker in the planning, research, and statistics office. And I loved it so much that I think it was February of 89, they had a position open, and I came back as a program analyst.
Great. Okay, so go ahead.
And then after being there with him, I worked with Ted for a couple years prior to the riot, and then had the opportunity to move up within the office. And when he became executive assistant, I think, to the commissioner, I ended up becoming the chief of that office, and then the office grew over the years. I became the director. So
great. Yeah. Excellent. And when did you leave
In 1998, I took a position with the governor's office of policy.
Okay, great. Yeah. All right, let's get to the riot. It is 2:30, 3 p.m. on Wednesday, October 25th, 1989. Where are you and what is happening?
I was actually in Ted's office, I think on the second floor. And we heard a commotion outside the window and turned around and saw a lot of inmates flooding into the yard right outside the window there below the tower, right in front of the lunchroom, the cafeteria.
At Central Office.
At Central Office. And we stood there for a while, and it became more and more chaotic. And it was obvious that there was a problem.
So that went on through pretty much the rest of that evening.
Yeah. But it was pretty disturbing. The thing I remember most about that, and at some point I can't recall. I was trying to think about this whether we went up to the commissioner's area or not. But I remember Frank Gillis being there with us, and there was an officer in particular that was on his knees right inside the gate below the tower that had a pillowcase over his head, or his head was covered, and there were about three inmates with him that were swinging a shovel or a pickaxe or something over his head. And I just remember being absolutely sick in my stomach that we were going to watch somebody killed directly in front of us. And Frank in particular was going very, very vocal, very upset that the officer in the tower did not fire a shot. And it seemed like it went on for 20 minutes until finally he did fire a shot. I think I recall Frank running out and telling him to fire. I was only a 26-year-old kid at the time, but that moment is seared in my brain when I think back to the riot. Just that the inmates swinging that shovel and then laughing. I don't think I'll ever get rid of that picture in my head.
Awful.
Yeah, it was.
So it ended that night, and then do you remember going home? What time you went home?
I do. It calmed down. I think the other thing, and I don't think. This probably doesn't mean anything to anybody else. The thing that I do remember going home, Ted told me go home. You know, there's really nothing that we could do at that point. I think the thing I remember going home was the previous day, we had a number of interns that we often took because I was a management intern, and I felt, you know, we like to have interns come through and rotate with us. The previous day, at the same time, I had four management interns taking a tour of the prison, and around 2:30 we had been at E-Gate the previous day. And the whole way home, I just kept going through my head, what if that had been today?
Wow.
So it's something that through the years I've thought about. And it's ironic, I've done some work at Penn State because my son went to college up there, and I ran into one of the interns who's now a vice president of development at Penn State, said, do you remember when you took me for that tour the day before the riot? So it's funny how, you know, these things even this many years, you know, he remembers.
Well, sure.
Yeah,
he probably turned on the TV and was watching it live thinking that, again, that could have been
that.
So,
I mean, you don't realize how many people are touched by things like this.
Exactly. So then the next day, you just came in for your normal work schedule?
We did. I remember we were compiling, you know, reports on overcrowding and other information. I remember in the months prior to the riot, in central office, we have been preparing a number of planning documents on the level of overcrowding in the system generally, and in certain institutions in particular, one of them being Camp Hill, because the people that were long-termers, you know, kept saying it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, because the prisons were so overcrowded.
By long-termers, you mean employees?
Long-term employees, yeah. We had some institutions like Camp Hill and others that were, you know, at 145% of, you know, design capacity, or and rated capacity were up at 180, and, you know, they were putting beds everywhere in dorm rooms, in cafeteria, or in gymnasiums. And we were, you know, Ted and I were developing plans, you know, with other departmental staff on how to address, you know, crowding, and we were sending things over to the governor's office to make them aware. So I remember that after the riot, we were pulling documents together because the governor's office wanted to know how can we address, you know, what are we going to do to address the...
But you'd been warning them for a good while.
We had been, and you know, and so... And, but hindsight, 2020.
Right, and the DOC just didn't have the money. I interviewed Linda Morrison, and she said, you know, to get equipment for and whatever they needed, she was scrounging through state surplus. So
yeah.
We just really didn't have any money. And Ted also talked about the fact that on a trip to Graterford, he saw all the cots in the gym.
Yeah, they were putting them everywhere. And I think the other thing that was a problem from a correctional standpoint was the mixing of populations. I know in particular Camp Hill, they were housing about a quarter of the population at that time was parole violators. So they had a large number of lifers, I think about 200 lifers. Now, on the other hand, you had about a quarter of the population that were parole violators, and they weren't programmed. So you had about, I think at the time, about 800 offenders that were not programmed, sitting idle. And from a correctional standpoint, anybody who knows correctional theory, that is a recipe for a disaster. Idle inmates, you've got young, volatile inmates, often parole violators who are jumpy and aggressive, and then long-term inmates, it's not a good mix from a population standpoint.
Right. So tell me how the second night started. Where were you when you learned about it?
Yeah. So one thing about that second day was how quiet it was. I still remember that. I don't know if anybody else mentioned that. I remember walking out to the car, but it just was so quiet that second day. Something didn't seem right. It seemed off. When the riot broke out that second night, I actually was at home. But I remember getting a call from my parents who were at the Camp Hill Mall, and they said something's going on at the prison. There's fire you can see from the parking lot at the mall coming up over. And if you know, the mall is right behind the train tracks there.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember calling Ted and saying, do we need to go in? He said, no, don't. At this point, they're trying to contain it. It's very not a good situation. So that night, I did not go in. But I went in early the next morning. I remember going in at like 5:30 or 6 and coming up over the hill there by the community church.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like a war zone. I mean, there were Molotov cocktails being thrown through the air. The prison was on fire. You could just see people silhouetted on the top of the buildings.
Running on the roofs.
And it really looked like scenes that I recall from a child, you know, from seeing on TV with Vietnam. It was crazy, pandemonium.
Right. So you got there probably about the time that the state police was just about ready to take it back.
I did, and we went up, I think, to your office. We were up there and watching when they, you know, they came in, brought the water cannon in, and then, you know, gradually got control, moved in from the two sides, and came in and got the inmates face down, and used the Ziploc cuffs to cuff them up.
Crazy.
It was a very intense scene.
Right.
Yeah.
Now tell me, now that it's over, how did it impact your work in the statistics office?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think, you know, what I recall was that after the riots, there were all these investigations going on. I know the Adams Commission was convened. So we provided a lot of data to them to help with the investigation. And there was an internal investigation they put together too. I remember John McCullough and Ken Kyler were brought in, and Ted and I worked with them quite a bit, providing them with information as well. And one of the things we started looking at was, you know, the data to see if, you know, information reports from Camp Hill to see if there were anything that was indicated there. And we actually, you know, when we started collecting the information from the population data, the information from the hearings data, the misconduct data, information from the staff information, the correspondence data. We started seeing some trends that were in the individual report, and when we put them into the computer and started graphing them, there were a lot of interesting information trends that it looked like if we had actually been able to look at them prior to the incident, we might have said, hey, there's something going on here that we should be paying attention to.
So now that you found all that data, mm-hmm. what did you do with it to help create a tool that corrections
right.
people
so,
would use?
So what we did is we looked at it and we saw that, you know, population side, you know, you had a prison that was at 187% of capacity. It had 2,500 inmates in prison that was, you know, rated at capacity was 1,800. They had over 1,000 double cell. A lot of people in cells and that were in dorms and modular. And it was an old institution. It was designed for youthful offenders. I mean, when I grew up there in the 70s, it had young offenders in there. So, you know, those things really spiked. We looked at staff personnel actions, and there were, you know, dramatic increase in the third quarter and fourth quarter with disciplinary actions against staff and grievances filed and terminations. Part of it was they moved away from manning the towers because they put the double fence in. So there were things there that they had released staff because they didn't need as many people. So that, you know, staff weren't happy. They didn't have as much overtime because they didn't need them because they were demanding the towers. Remember, that was a big thing as we increased security with the fencing. They didn't need the towers manned.
Somebody mentioned to me that at the time we were also opening facilities like Retreat and Smithfield, and I forget the other ones, but somebody said that what happened was a lot of the veteran staff moved on to the other facilities, leaving a less...
They did, and the other thing that we found was that a lot of the younger staff, because of staff bidding, ended up on the 2-10 shift. So staff experience was significantly younger on that shift.
Wow. Okay.
So that was another problem in terms of knowing how to handle what emerged.
And of course, what I think is interesting too is the inmates were watching all of this.
Exactly. And then they had some other things in terms of institutional climate. You saw that they had the policy with the family picnic suddenly taken away, very upsetting to the inmates. They had a sick leave policy changed abruptly, so things like that. During the summer, there were increased assaults against staff, but then they declined. But the correspondence, the complaints through the correspondence by the inmates totally went through the roof. These were things that if you had, again, not had siloed systems, you would have seen it. So basically what we recommended and what Ken and John have recommended, is we need to put an integrated system together. And that's really was the impetus for developing the SCAN system.
Tell us what SCAN stands for.
So SCAN is State Corrections Analysis Network.
Okay.
We had actually started looking at developing an integrated system. Andy Kaiser, who was an IT coordinator at Crescent at the time, in April we had started looking at other states were doing and we'd started, you know, seeing what we could do. And after, you know, looking at the data from Camp Hill, we decided we needed to accelerate it. I think in January of that following year, Commissioner Owens had sent a letter out and said we're going to get a team together from the institutions and the department to take a look at developing this. And then by the end of that year, we had developed an approach and implemented the policy in the following year. And I believe they still have a climate indicator system today, some 30 years later. But basically what it did is it monitored information across all of the major departments in an integrated way, and we looked at statistical band of normality. So if something went outside of causal range, what was chance, we would force a communication between the institution and department and say, you know, we see a spike in assaults, or we see a spike in correspondence in this area, is there something going on? And it helped to force that communication, because prior to that, I think there, you know, a lot of times institutions were sort of on an island, and it really just was to help people to take a look at things they might not otherwise see.
Great. And then I hear that you received documentation from a longtime superintendent, well-respected Dr. Joseph Mazurkiewicz from Rockview, who actually said that the tool was helpful.
Yeah, when I was pulling things together to come in and meet with you, it's interesting, as being a policy research person, I tend to keep things, and it must have meant something to me, and obviously did, but I have found a note from Doc Cho talking about the value of the system. It was helping to provide some clarity and help them to keep eye on things that they might not otherwise do, so that obviously meant a lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then tell me how your work in this area actually was used to help other states.
Yeah, so after the riot, I mean, I think, you know, Camp Hill sort of became something that other states were interested in. We were contacted by the National Institute of Corrections and asked to help put together, so be part of their riots and control course that they do for other superintendents and staff. And for several years, we were part of that and helped them to teach other superintendents how to develop a key indicator system, talked about what happened at Camp Hill, what we found, and then also went through a sort of a process of how you develop these systems, how you, you know, different ways that states have developed them, and then the process of putting them together and implementing them. So we feel like what we learned at Camp Hill we shared with other states, and also we shared it with some military institutions as well. So it had some widespread impact on other institutions nationally.
So while it was very traumatic, a lot of good came out of
absolutely. And it's interesting because having that experience, I've used that throughout my career. When I went to the governor's office, the policy office, implemented similar systems there for other cabinet agencies, and with my work at KPMG, I've done that with other agencies as well, because the principles are the same. Whether you're in corrections or somewhere else, you want to give decision makers the information they need to quickly understand what's going on in their agencies and to proactively address it. So it has application whether it's in corrections or welfare or any other agency.
Well, thank you for your work, because it's still in use today, and
it's very
important.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's been a passion of love, and actually, to see that it's still used in some way here, it's very rewarding, because it protects staff and it protects the offender population as well.
And the community as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because if that one vehicle had breached through the fence, we'd have had a huge community problem.
Yeah, I think, Sue, it's even more important as technology has become more proliferated, because what I've seen is, in the following 30 years, there's so much data now, and there's no way that people can manage all that by manually reviewing it. And now with the bigger computer systems and data mining and automated intelligence, you have the ability to mine that data and really have it tell you what are the things that you should be looking at. And there's no way that a person can manually do that.
Right.
So it becomes even more important with today's automated systems.
Right. So what else did you want to share?
Well, I think what's interesting too is not only what happened, but how it's an interesting thing that I think after the riot, all the good that came out of it. I mean, we were very fortunate. I think everybody would acknowledge, and I enjoyed reading the transcripts from the other people you've talked to. But the good that came out of something really bad, the fact that nobody was killed is a tremendous outcome, obviously. But from something bad, some really good things came. And I just thought I'd touch on them.
Please do.
I'm pulling some information. I thought there's really seven things that I think that came out of the riots after the disturbance. And I think it's interesting. So in April of 1990, that's when Commissioner Layman was brought in after a national search. And I think it's really started the change of the structure of the department. I know you're going to do a thing on the history of the department, but it sort of really changed how the department looks and how it is today. So one of the things you see after reviewing all the investigations on the riot, the Adams Commission, the internal one, the Senate and the House, is this is a treatment versus operation clash. And that led to communication struggles and struggles in the prison, and the inmates felt that. So one of the first changes that Commissioner Layman made was to say, well, we're going to eliminate that, and we're going to go to a regional geographic break of the department and move towards institutional centralized inmate services versus institutional management. So you get away from the treatment operations, we're going towards an inmate focused and institutional management focused. And then we're going to organize our department, our institutions around geographic splits. And you get away from that us versus they mentality. So that was a huge change, and we still have pretty much have that today.
Yeah.
I think the second thing then was to improve the interinstitutional and departmental communications, and that was done through the STAN system, looking at climate and forcing communications, and we talked about that. The third thing was to say that you have to improve the readiness of staff. And even though we did have CERT teams, they weren't fully developed like they are. I know you talked to, I know that Secretary Beard talked about this, and JD, and probably Bill Sprinkle with the Training Academy. But we got a grant from NIC, we got equipment that we need to, you know, train our staff and put a formalized training program together for CERT, make sure that our people have the curriculum, the training, and the equipment that they need to do to protect our institutions and know how to respond, and they held regular emergency drills. That wasn't really in place before that, so that was a huge professional step forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
The fourth thing was for emergency preparedness was to develop professional standards, policies, and procedures. And I don't know, I'm sure we're talking to JD, I mean, he probably, he probably spoke to this, but prior to that, we had policies, but they weren't sort of, you know, formalized and standardized. And I remember JD coming in, and by the time he left, probably had a stack of policy binders the size, the length of your desk here. The checklist, very organized, standardized, and that whole process led us to being able to move towards ACA accreditation for all of our institutions. And it was a mammoth undertaking to redo all the policies, not just the ones around about emergency preparedness and MOUs with all the local officials and state police and PEMA, but across all of our policies.
Wow.
It was a major undertaking. And I don't know that people think about that happened after the math of the Camp Bell riots.
We have thousands of policies.
I know, but we rewrote all of them.
Wow.
The fifth was recognizing the specific security deficiencies after Camp Hill was to move towards hard concrete modular units and cells. And, you know, doing that, looking at dividing exercise yards by having interior fencing and making sure that there was exterior perimeter lighting. And so that was something that was done at Camp Hill. And then following that, recognizing that the prison population was not going to, you know, abate in any way, the department launched the biggest construction ever in the history, and by 97 added 10,000 cells through the prototypical prison expansion effort. And Curtis Pulitzer, a national architect recognizing corrections, was brought in. We brought a committee together on prototypicals and basically guided our development of prison construction across the state. And it was a mammoth undertaking, and all these things happening at the same time. And then I think the final thing was to be more proactive in shaping the policies that impact the department. And, you know, Joe Lehman created the executive deputy position so that deputy sort of oversaw the managing of the institutions and the department internally, and he became more proactive on the Hill, helping to shape the legislation that impacted us. Because during the 80s and 90s, you got slammed with the mandatory sentences and the enhancements for weapons and everything else, which led to the overcrowding. But by getting more involved and influencing on the Hill, you could change some of those.
We didn't have a voice at the
time.
We
did not. And he was the first one that really gave us a voice. And I think all of our commissioners and secretaries moved us to a secretary since then have, you know, been champions. I mean, you had Morty Horn and you had Jeff Beard, and now Commissioner Secretary Wetzel. Mm-hmm. All of them have been advocates, and I think we've been probably, I think it'd be hard to argue that any department in the nation has had the list of excellent secretaries that we've had, starting with. All this, in a way, is a result of the riot.
Yeah.
And it's amazing all the things that were done following this. It's absolutely, if you think about it, I reread this the other night when I was new, I was telling you, it boggles your mind.
Right.
So I think it's absolutely incredible that, you know, the Phoenix rises, but absolutely incredible that rewriting security responses, organizational structure, policies, construction, training, and legislative approach all came out of something so terrible.
Mm.
Pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. This has been wonderful.
Well, it was a little bit different. I mean, it's not that I was in it, but like I said, a 26-year-old kid, eyes open, ears, you know, mouth closed. It was an incredible, you know, thing to live through, and it certainly has shaped my career, and something you won't ever forget. I'm sure you too. We both said we were kids at the time,
right?
And it was an incredible event, and I think certainly shaped the history of this department
and set us up for success.
It did, in a strange way, it did.
Yeah,
it's a legacy for this department that was terrible, but set a lot of positive things up.
It's amazing. Yeah. Anything else you want to share?
I just commend you for doing this. This is a mammoth undertaking, and it's hard to believe it's 30 years, but I know it's hard for you to go through this as well.
Well, thank you.
But it does bring back some bad memories, but I think it's very good to reflect. It's always good to reflect. And then, you know, look back and look forward. It's always a positive thing.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, Leanne.
Absolutely.